You're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast with your host, Giovanni Puccini. Today's GP Soccer Podcast is brought to you by the DiBernardo Soccer School. Hey there, everyone. Giovanni Puccini here, host of the... Go ahead, say it. Yep, the GP Soccer Podcast. That's me. That's my little show here. Not so little anymore, which is a good thing. Keeps growing. Real pleased about that. And I guess I'll never stop thanking you, my audience, new folks who are listening, my repeat listeners. Repeat listeners, because as you know, you can listen to a podcast as many times as you like. So thanks very much for listening, tuning in today. I got a great show today. I think it's a really important show. It's a very timely show. As you all know, overstate the obvious, we're dealing with the COVID-19 crisis. Not going away anytime soon, at least not in this country, until some substantive things take place at the national level. Not going to get into politics. But until things we make some dramatic changes here in the United States, we're in the midst of this pandemic. Our guest I have on today is John Barata. And you'll get to learn about John when I do his bio and we do the interview in a little bit. But the reason why I had John on is because he wears three very significant hats, that as a youth soccer director of coaching, a club director of coaching, and he's the head coach of a boys' high school team here in the Boston area over at Oliver Ames High School. And his background is very, very significant, as you will learn as we, like I said, go through his bio and go through the conversation. So we're really going to kind of get really deep into, how the virus has impacted soccer, both at the youth level, the club level, and at the high school level. We'll talk about, the playing modifications, and they are significant, particularly in the high school realm, and then the training modifications that are taking place. And I think as you listen to the conversation and you're involved in youth soccer, club soccer, even if you're a high school coach, you're going to learn a great deal about what's taking place in Easton and at Legacy and in Oliver Ames, where John is, but, in general, particularly here in Massachusetts. So a really great conversation. John and I are good friends. We go back many years. We're very good colleagues, and it's just a joy to have him as an interview guest. Typically, he and I will meet at a local Dunkin' Donuts for a couple of cups of coffee, but that's not taking place these days because of this blooming virus. So we'll be talking with John a little bit. A little bit of a heads up with the show. I'm going to return to the GP Soccer Podcast being a weekly broadcast. New shows will come up every Wednesday for season 3. And season 3 will take us right up until the holiday season, where we take our winter break, our holiday break, and we will reconvene for season 4 sometime toward the end of January. I do that, just to enjoy the holidays and enjoy that little bit of a break. And we start up around that time because people are starting to think about spring soccer. There are a lot of coaching education courses are taking place in those months leading to the spring season. So it's a nice time to kick off the next season. I like attending the United Soccer Coaches National Convention in January. So I come back with a lot of new stuff, if you will, people that I've met, new things that I've learned, and it just adds to the content of future shows. Now this year, United Soccer Coaches will be a virtual convention. I will be having Ian Barker on as a guest in upcoming episodes where he and I will talk, all things United Soccer Coaches, and we will certainly get into, this new world with a virtual convention where, you don't have to travel to a locale, as would have been the case this year out in California. You can enjoy, big air quotes there, enjoy, albeit in a different kind of scenario, the full extent of a coaches convention virtually on your smart device. So he and I will be talking about, like I said, all things United Soccer Coaches and the virtual United Soccer Coaches convention, that we typically would be having in California. So That's where we're at. That's where we're at. So this is going to be a real short setup. I really want to kind of dive right in with my conversation with John Barata. I want to, you know, kind of get that going for all of you because I know that you will enjoy it. So we're going to have a commercial message, an ad break. You know, got to have these things. Got to have these things. Like, got bills to pay, and advertising pays the bills. And if you'd like to advertise, you know who to contact. You know how that works. But we'll break for a short commercial message. On the other side, we will reconvene. And I'll introduce you to my good friend, John Barata. Please, don't go anywhere. What if I were to tell you that there is an opportunity to experience cutting-edge soccer coaching education for incredible prices? A program where you can choose a youth diploma, senior diploma, or cognitive soccer diploma. How about taking courses that are designed to deliver impactful information that will change the way you teach the game? Well, that can all be found at the DiBernardo Soccer School. Coach Marcus DiBernardo is a worldwide leader in cognitive soccer coaching, and his work has been featured in Europe, South America, and in the United States. Most recently, he was the only American invited to present at the Conference for Soccer and Neuroscience. The DiBernardo Soccer School proudly announces the first ever Virtual Director of Coaching program. This one-of-a-kind program partners with your club, is 100% customizable, and features such options as Coach DiBernardo training your coaches virtually, providing your club with comprehensive coaching methodologies for every age group, ideas for business development, providing marketing materials for your club website, and so much more. For further information, visit CoachDiBernardo.com or contact Marcus DiBernardo at CoachDiBernardo@gmail.com.
Hi, I'm Misty Price, head soccer coach at Wellesley College and a vice president on the United Soccer Coaches Board of Directors, and you're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast with Giovanni Pacini.
Hey, welcome back to the GP Soccer Podcast. I am your host. You know who I am. I'm Giovanni Pacini. As I noted to you before the commercial break, we got another terrific guest on today. And again, I say this quite often. You've heard me say it. I hope you never get sick of me saying it because I think it's indicative of a lot of us who are in the game and spend any real length of time in the game. The person I have on today, who's John Barata, is also a friend. And it's always a treat. It's always a double pleasure, if you will, that when you have a professional relationship with someone, they're good colleagues in the game, but you can also say, hey, this person is my friend, and John Barata is certainly one of those people. So because of that, I'm really pleased to have him on today. So you're asking, well, who is this guy, John Barata? Well, here's John Barata. So my guest is indeed John Barata. He is a U.S. Soccer A-licensed coach and United Soccer Coaches Master Coach. And he leads one of the most successful boys soccer programs in Massachusetts over at Oliver Ames High School. Taking over the program in 2009, John has led Oliver Ames to state championships, South sectional championships, and winning the Hockomock League numerous times. John is also the CEO and director of coaching for the Legacy Soccer Club and is the founder of the Beautiful Game Soccer Academy. John Barata, welcome to the GP Soccer Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Giovanni. It's always a pleasure to catch up. And certainly times have changed. So we're no longer able to catch up at Dunkin' Donuts. So we're catching up online. So that's great to hear you still doing great work. And congrats on success here with GP Soccer Podcast and all the wonderful things you're doing for the game. So thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate that. Well, you know, to my audience, John and I do meet together regularly over at Dunkin' Donuts. We share a couple of cups of coffee. And we talk soccer for goodness knows long periods of time. And I miss that too, John. Like all of us, we miss those face-to-face relationships that we enjoy in the game. But, you know, technology is kind of filled in a little bit. It's not the same. It's not the same, but here we are. And I think, and you can attest to this, I think everyone's middle name is Zoom these days. you know, I'm just going to add it to my middle name, Giovanni Antonio Zoom Pacini. It's helped me immensely in the work that I've done in the game. So, and it's helping us today as we use it for this interview. So John, where I like to start with all my guests and the folks who are regular listeners know this, is that I enjoy, and I know the audience enjoys, hearing people's story. So before we kind of get into the meat and potatoes as to why you're here today and the topics we'll cover, what is the John Barata story? Like, where did you grow up? Where did you play? Did you have any influences, you know, growing up in the game? And did you have any favorite teams? Or so kind of in a nutshell, what is the John Barata story?
Yeah, well, the John Barata story, I guess we'll say that I've been in the game since I can remember. My parents, I'm from Danbury, Connecticut, originally. So I am not a Massachusetts born coach slash player, which was interesting because my when I had to get moved here or I transplanted here, it's tough to break into a new system and a new state and a new kind of a network. So being from Danbury, Connecticut, I had a lot of fun trying to make my way here in the soccer world back in 2004. But prior to getting here, I was, again, as I stated, I was in Danbury, Connecticut. I went to Immaculate High School, where I was blessed to have, you know, some great mentors. And obviously my father, Chico, the coach, Carlo Pascuzzi, and then Joe Mingachos, who actually Joe Mingachos is still an outstanding coach at the collegiate ranks. So I've had those guys who helped me throughout my high school career, along with Wayne Monez, who was at Western Connecticut, was early on in my career. He was very influential. And so was Mark Swanda, who was from Newtown, who still runs, believe it or not, the Newtown Pride team. They actually won a national championship last year. So my upbringing has been around the game for a long time as a player in the Danbury Youth Soccer Network, then a Newtown Premier, and then just kind of graduated up to the high school ranks, where I've been blessed to play with a lot of great players and have a lot of fun. Then I went on to college. Obviously, I went to Assumption College. For some of you that represent the Greyhounds, that'd be great to hear. But also, I got to play for Peter Gardula and John Murphy. John Murphy is a dear friend and a mentor still at this point. We also got to meet Nick Palanzis, who's a bit of a local legend in the soccer world. So my journey started in Massachusetts back in like 1997, 96, when I went to college here at Assumption. So the rest of the story really is I graduated. You know, we all want to play a little bit of pro afterwards. You give it a whirl, you give it a shot, you do your thing. My kind of attempts to play after school kind of faded quickly with a health issue that I've dealt with. So ever since 2001, I've really focused my career on more just coaching. Just couldn't give the game up. You know, the game may have passed me by on the field, but I couldn't give the game up as a soccer fan, coach, educator, and just wanted to be involved. So I guess the story starts from the coaching journey, you know, right in college when I was working with Coach John Murphy. But then after college, when I just got right into coaching with you know, John Salvatore and Craig Horn on a soccer extreme, right after 2000, 2001. And then obviously the rest is kind of history. When I moved into Easton in 2005 as a part-time director of coaching. And then I also was doing youth ministry at the church in Hanover, St. Mary's, working as a life team youth minister in 2005 through 2008. And then soccer started to take off for me after finally making building a reputation here in Massachusetts that helped me become more of a full-time director of coaching for Easton. I then became the away coach. And then from there, multiple opportunities have arisen, and I've been very fortunate to continue in the game. So I guess I hope that's a quick nutshell of 42 years of what's been happening. So
there you go. Well, you came across some real characters there in Wayne Monis, Nick Palanzis, and certainly John Murphy. They're friends of mine as well. You know, you were very lucky in Danbury, Connecticut. That's certainly considered a hot spot in the state of Connecticut, and arguably across New England in terms of you know, youth soccer and club soccer and that type of environment. So, well, that's great. You know, we kind of get an idea of, you know, where you're all about. Let me ask you question associated with that. Did you have, John, one of those aha moments where, you know, hey, I want to do this soccer thing? Were you on a different career track? You know, you said you went to Assumption. Were you headed somewhere else? Or was it always, I'm going to be involved in the game in some way, shape, or form to make it a full-time professional endeavor?
No, I mean, to be honest, you know, at that time, I mean, remember, so this is like back in 2000, I had taken a accepted a job preliminary with a nuclear power plant in Indian Head, New York, in Buchanan, just because my degree was environmental science and other dynamics. So I had taken a different role. But to be honest, I didn't know soccer was a pathway. Had I known soccer was going to be a pathway, I may have done other things in college for other coursework, just so, which is now more available, sports management, international business, other things along those lines. However, I did have a moment. It was when I got sick and my soccer playing career kind of ended. You know, I'm a big believer in one door closes, something else opens up. So by that happening and my career coming to an end, I ended up actually reconnecting with my wife, which is now my wife, obviously my current wife. And, you know, things went from there, right? So on a personal side, my aha moment was, you know, giving up on that dream of trying to play ball somewhere because the game had passed me by for whatever reason, health or other issues. And I decided that I just wanted to do something I was happy with. The nuclear power plant wasn't something that made me happy, to be honest, right? So when I got sick, I realized, you know, I want to do something that's going to make me happy for whatever I've got going on. And my moment was probably July 23rd, 2001, when I decided that I was going to do something I wanted to do for fun and enjoy, because that's when I got diagnosed with my kind of ailments. So other than that, I would say that that's my big moment, which was to do what I want to do and enjoy doing as long as I possibly can.
You know, I had an interesting conversation with another friend slash colleague of mine about this very issue about, you know, having coached in college for a million years and, you know, you see these kids come in and they go through 4 years and they graduate, they go out and get a quote unquote real job. And then shortly thereafter, you know, you get a phone call, you get an email, you get a text. And I know it's happened to me. Hey, Coach Pacini, I really think I want to coach. Just can you help me? How should I go about doing this? You know, I think folks sometimes have to go get a taste of the real world in a profession, and no matter what it happens to be, before they say, you know what, I think I want to kind of go back to the game and do something with the game. So it sounds like that's kind of, you know, kind of where you're at, you know, doing something in nuclear energy, and then boy, taking a big shift. Thankfully for all of us, John, you took the turn to soccer. So the primary reason I have you in particular on the show is because you wear several hats, several important hats. You're involved in youth soccer over at Easton. You're involved with your club, with the Legacy Club, and you're a high school coach, right? So you bring some unique expertise in all of those areas. And I want to focus in on the, you know, we always have to continue talking about this, the COVID-19 crisis. And I'd like to get your perspective in each of those areas as to how it affected you, it affected those entities that you have been involved with. So let's start with on the youth side or on the club side. So share with my audience, the chronology on how you dealt with managing your club in Eastern Youth Soccer as the COVID-19 virus kind of descended upon all of us. Kind of walk us through the beginning phases of that into where we're at now and the things that you really had to deal with because they were unprecedented.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously the pandemic took us all by a bit of a surprise, right? I had just flown back in from Portugal when I was at Benfica doing a 10-day study and review on their policies and procedures as they work with their academy players. So I had just returned back on February 23rd, 24th, and then like within 3 weeks, we were kind of shut down and phase one of our, you know, pandemic, we'll say just situation where nothing was happening, nothing was going on. You're in the middle of your winter training, you're trying to get ready for spring training and your spring season. So what really occurred that caught all of us off, you know, kind of off guard was just the fact that no one knew what was going on, whether it was parents, whether it was educators, whether it was club owners. So it was about really adapting quickly to a challenging situation. So from what our perspective, we were able to adjust and we were pretty nimble rather quickly. We got right onto the online training platforms, right? So we were able to go online right away. We had partnered with the Top Techers, and we had also gone and offered our families TED Ed quizzes, and we did Zoom meetings, and we did a number of videos. So we were very fortunate that we were able to maneuver rather quickly, and get going and offer our parents the best possible experience we could with what we were given. And that was very challenging from March through, to be honest, the beginning of June, until we actually were able to start to get outside and do some cohort training. So it was almost 3 months of online personal accountability. We were doing a lot of things where the kids had to do work and track it on Google Sheets. So what we did is we engaged our Legacy Virtual Training Academy, which is what we had to do to get the kids going. And we created some phases, like an activation phase, then it was an energizing phase, then it was an implementation phase, and then it went to the, you know, a competition phase in June when we finally had to get back outside. So we had to adapt and adjust, but then we had to deal with something that, you know, as you know, parents, you know, we didn't provide the full service of games, right? And although to a soccer coach, we all believe that the training environment is most important, sometimes the parents, the competition is, they believe that that's kind of what they need for their kids. So we had to all as clubs deal with, you know, a refund process, a credit process. We're entering a new world of liability discussions. We're also talking now about the opportunities for, you know, what is the new refund policy for clubs going forward? How are we handling payments for the future? So there was a lot of things, Joe, Vani, that occurred during that time frame. And that's some of the stuff we did to mitigate and to just deal with those challenges.
I have spoken at length about this issue in youth sport, and we'll get into this a little bit later, but I've spoken about the risk and liability. So let's hone in on that for a second. What was the advice? What were the guidelines that were afforded to you by legal counsel relative to risk management and the liability that you might assume in the tragic event someone, you know, one of your players or, you know, parents or whomever, you know, gets COVID and the worst happens?
So I think it's a two-part question, right? So number one, I'll say that from a legal counsel perspective, that information has been really important now, coming forward now, because now that we're outside and getting into competitive environments where we're competing with other players outside of our, we'll say, our cohort, which is our club. And that's an interesting one that we'll get back to, because as I'm sure you're aware, youth sports and in general, no insurance company is actually covering COVID-19 liability. So that was something that's interesting. And if you ever have 35 minutes you want to watch, or anyone on here to watch, Massachusetts Youth Soccer put together a great webinar that describes the COVID-19 liability and explains in pretty good detail what is covered, what is not covered, and then what other protections are in place for an organization that follows the guidelines set forth by your state. So Giovanni, a lot of, you know, from the legal perspective, as long as you're trying to do the right things and you're not grossly negligent, right, which means you're ignoring the guidelines of the state or you're trying to walk a fine line, then at least you have some protections. However, if you're just grossly negligent and ignoring the guidelines, then you may have a lot more of exposure than you would prefer. So that's one. The second point is Massachusetts Soccer has been terrific in providing us with guidance and details about what to do. I mean, the exposure was really minimal, to be honest, during the Zoom and online components. The exposure is what we're worried about now, is making sure we keep our kids safe and healthy. But if there was to be some type of case, you just want to make sure that you've done your best to keep everyone as safe as possible in the environment you've created. Because I got to be honest, it'd be very hard for anyone to prove they got sick at a soccer field when all the kids are back in school. So I think some of that is, you know, the risk is going to be mitigated or spread across the entire board of everything that's a player is involved in now, not just your soccer environment.
The million-dollar word, negligence. The million-dollar word. So let's now talk about, since we've reached a point where you're on the field, what modifications have taken place? And I'm familiar with it, but maybe there's some folks out there in my audience that are not super aware of the modifications that have taken place on the training, in the training environment, in the playing environment. And I know that it has varied from, you know, from state to state, from a state like ours here in Massachusetts, which has done, I believe, a wonderful job in laying things out in detailed fashion so the kids can get out in the field in a somewhat safe environment, to states where there's nothing, Like there's nothing. I have a, without naming names or clubs, I have a colleague down in Florida. It's the Wild West in Florida. There's no restrictions. There's nothing. They've been playing, they've been doing camps. And my head continues to explode when I hear that type of behavior. But anyways, so talk to us first about the training environments. How have the training environments in the youth game been altered? How have they changed?
Yeah, so, you know, a quick point that you mentioned there about the cross states, you're right. It's different across every state. And I will just speak that there are some cases now coming out that clubs in other states that haven't abided by any type of regulations are starting to have some challenges with COVID-19. So I am very grateful that we live in the state we do. And although some people may not like some of the restrictions, I'm just happy that for player safety, we've taken the strong approach, and for parent safety, because, you know, as you know, Giovanni, it's more about humanity at some point than it is just about the game. The game, the blessing we have is that we have made no mistakes, and we can't make any mistakes in this realm, in my opinion, because this is just an opportunity to learn, because no one's ever lived this before right now. So we're all just learning. So I believe that our current training environment is another learning phase for us. And I think it's the best we can do. We keep the kids socially distant, and it's been a graduated approach, Gio. So starting in June, right, we had social distance training where there was no contact permitted at all, right? So you kept the kids 6 feet apart. When the players arrive to a field, there's a safe zone where they should put their bags and their equipment that only they can use 6 feet apart, right? So we've had designated, and we've diagrammed out how our coaches would keep our kids separated during training and games. Once they arrive to the training environment, from June to now, it has progressed significantly, because now all the kids are wearing masks to play. So we're allowed to have contact, or minimal contact, of course. But the modifications to keep us safe, we've been sanitizing every 10 to 15 minutes. The kids have water breaks every 5 to 10 minutes simply because of the masks. So it's really more of just a lot more prep work. But as you know, Giovanni, as a coach, and you've educated thousands of coaches in your domain, and you've traveled the world, preparation is a huge part of coaching, right? So all we're doing now is adding a little more prep work to our coaches, and we're just asking them to be a little more helpful to remind players of proper safety measures and protocols, right? So we are playing soccer now. The modified rules are now in effect, right? Which is no heading, no throw-ins, and a couple of others, no shoulder to shoulder, to help keep the game at least alive for us during the fall season as we continue to navigate the COVID-19. But those are some of the measures that are taking place. It's more of a lot of prep work. And we're very blessed. We have Blast Shoot Soccer with Ian Mulliner and Mike Borislow and all those guys up there with Tommy Geis and Loy that provide us with a lot of good information to use. So we're very lucky as a state to be in the situation we are.
Indeed. I agree wholeheartedly. And to folks who, you know, my audience here who are from Massachusetts, then if you have not already, certainly, you know, utilize the Massachusetts Youth Soccer website for all the things John had just talked about, and we're sharing here with all of you. You know, if you're still trying to, you know, get up to speed, so to speak, to ensure that your players and parents, for that matter, you know, if the parents dropping their kids off, you know, are in the safest environment, you know, possible, then these you must follow these protocols, and these protocols are available to you right there at the Mass Youth Soccer website. So you mentioned you know, the playing modifications have taken place. Have you started to compete? How is you're at a point now where you said you're playing games? What is the competition environment looking like?
So funny enough, we start our league play for the club this weekend. But I did get a chance to coach my daughter and my son in my volunteer role last weekend in Whitman Youth Soccer, Whitman Hansen Rec Program. And you know what? They were fine. They play with the new rules. It was interesting. Every time the ball touched someone's hand, the ref stopped the whistle, and they have to sanitize the ball and got a new ball in play. There were a couple of moments where anytime a hand landed on a player, even if it was incidental, the ref would blow the whistle, and it was an indirect. So the game was choppy at bits to start. But I think overall, those kids just wanted to be out there playing soccer and getting accustomed to the masks will take a little bit of doing, but they had games. I mean, the kids, fifth, sixth grade girls and seventh, eighth grade boys, they enjoyed themselves. They had a blast. And it wasn't exactly, you know, the purest form of soccer. No, it wasn't. However, was it wonderful? Yes. Great to be out there. So I'll let you know. I'll report to you after this weekend when we have our first 20 games for the club. I'll let you know how that goes.
No, John, absolutely. Please do. As a matter of fact, I'd love to have you back on, even for a brief segment where you talk about that experience. I would love to hear about that. I'm sure the audience would love to listen to that as well, to get a firsthand account, of a competition environment of that size. So I'll take you up on that, my friend. I'll take you up on that. So let's look at this. Let's get off the field. Let's look at it from a business perspective. And I think I already know the answers, but I want to hear it from you as well. So how has the COVID-19 situation affected your club, legacy, and Eastern U Soccer from a business standpoint? Because at the end of the day, you know, we talk soccer. We want to develop coaches. We want to develop players. We want to create wonderful soccer environments. But let's not kid ourselves. This is a business. This is a business. So how has this pandemic affected those entities from a business standpoint?
Yeah, so I mean, you have a couple things that factor in here, right? You have parents that are upset that they can't be at games or at practices unless they're socially distant or they're 6 feet apart, right? Because that's one of the requirements as well, is parents should stay in their cars, parents should drop off and go back to their cars, parents that stay on a field must be socially distant, you can only have one spectator per player. So right off the bat, your consumer and your customer in this industry are different. So your consumer, being the player, may be as happy as can be, but the customer, which is your paying member, is angry. Because
it's a win-lose.
Yeah, but it really is. So the challenge is, from a business perspective, I've been on many calls with people in my own personal experience. Business is down from many, many clubs and many youth sports. Some organizations just can't put teams together. Some won't put kids on the field because they just don't have the bandwidth from a town perspective. Again, on both those cases, I'm very blessed and very fortunate that Eastern Youth Soccer, we're thriving right now. Our numbers are fine for the fall. Actually, we've limited numbers this fall simply because of COVID-19 restrictions, but we've almost maxed out on every program we have. So we're okay with it. I mean, we suffered all the spring, right? Spring and summer, we lost, you know, our revenue from camps, our revenue from spring programs. So yes, we're down. But the key is we're ready to bounce back and give kids what they need. From a club perspective, you know, our numbers actually are up by 75 players, right? So we've added 4 or 5 teams during the situation with strategic alliances and partnerships. And what we've been able to do is overcome a very tough time. And looking forward, we all understand we're going to make any money or we'll lose money this year. But the hope is that in the future, we'll all be able to make out going forward in a positive manner. And for those that are doing the right things, usually parents are very supportive of it. Not everyone is always happy, Giovanni, but for the most part, if you're communicative and you really try and do the right thing by your parents, usually they stick with you and they trust you. And I've been very lucky right now that in both Easton and in at Legacy, I've had that great fortune of parents that are pretty amazing. And again, a lot of people really appreciate us doing the right thing and following all the guidelines. That's been really amazing to me, is how much support we're getting because we're doing a pretty good job of following all the guidelines.
Such an important word there, John, trust. Such an important word. You do need to establish that, maintain it, never take it for granted, even under the best of circumstances. But given the challenges that we have now discussed in the youth and club environment, you've got to establish that trust, you know, from a moral standpoint, but also from a business standpoint. You know, let's cut to reality, that if that trust is compromised, that trust is breached, then it is going to affect your bottom line. Parents are going to pull their kids because, heck, I'm not sending my kid to that club or that, you know, that youth soccer organization because, my goodness, they're not doing the right thing. So, trust, super valuable. Again, you're here because you wear several different very important hats, and you're wonderful with all the hats that you wear. High school, you're a successful high school coach over at Oliver Ames. And let me sidetrack for a second. If you have a chance, you're in the Boston area, You're a fan of high school soccer, and you should be. If you get a chance to go see Oliver Ames play, you're going to see a terrific high school program. You're going to see some terrific soccer. Terrific soccer. I'm not saying this because John is my friend and we have a relationship. If I didn't believe it, I wouldn't say it. I wouldn't say it. But make sure you take a moment to go down and see Oliver Ames High School play. John just does a real nice job of getting kids to play the game the way it really should be played. And there's no surprise as to why his teams do so well and they go off to play, you know, at the college level, because it's such a quality playing environment. So let me tip my cap to you, John. For the job you do at Oliver Ames, not just for the wins and losses, but boy, what a nice product you put on the field and watching your kids play a really nice level of soccer. So with that hat on, John, again, we'll kind of go the chronological route. So share with the audience the sequence of events that ultimately affected fall sports, which obviously includes soccer. When this COVID thing kind of hit and the realization became, you know, clear that, oh my goodness, this could affect the fall. Oh my goodness, this could affect soccer. Oh my God, we need to do X, Y, Z. Take us on that journey to where you are now, because where we're at in the calendar, correct me if I'm wrong, the high school season is starting pretty soon. We're still early to mid-September. You're getting ready to start, aren't you?
Yeah, so September 18th is our, sounds funny to say, it's our preseason kickoff. September 18th, we'll start our preseason, then we have 10 days of preseason, and then we go into our 5 days of training, and then our first game will be the first week of October. So that's the current plan, as long as everything stays on track, right, and on a positive turn here, especially with COVID-19. So to give you a little bit of background, as of last spring, everyone's already worried about what the fall will look like, simply because MIA canceled all the spring sports at the end there, simply because there was no way of getting it in a safe environment. So the panic started to set in for my seniors, which is interesting. Giovanni, I appreciate the kind words. I believe that the kids do well despite their coaching. So the good thing is the kids I have now, I have about 13 seniors that are coming back that were excited to go for the state championship this year. And we found out early on that there would be no state tournament. And, you know, obviously you're dealing with disappointed players, disappointed kids from a competitive point of view. But then you start to get closer to the season and everyone's saying there may not be a season, right? So come July, they're still saying that it was up in the air whether there's going to be a fall season. So now kids are just nervous about, I'm not going to be able to play my senior year, right? So there was a reality of, I can't believe I'm not going to get a chance to play the senior year that I've been waiting for my entire career. Not only can I not compete in a playoff, but I can't even play. So now you're dealing with those kids, their feelings, their emotions. I don't even want to talk about the parents because they're on a different playing field because there's a lot of politics and other things involved there. But everyone's just kind of frustrated and up in arms. Then the MIA comes out with, we are going to play, right? We're going to give it a whirl. It's going to be up to every school committee, right? So that's been the last battle for the last 4 weeks, is everyone saying, hey, what are we doing? Every school committee is making their own decisions. Then all the leagues are making their own decisions. So some leagues, as you know, have canceled completely and want to try to squeeze into this new wedge season, which is going to be March and April, which I'm going to find it to be very interesting to see how we're going to squeeze soccer onto grass fields in March or April, at that point. But also more interesting, if we're at a positivity rate of only 0.9 now, I'm not so sure it's going to be any lower come March or April. So I'm not so sure if we're actually not going to be playing with these rules anyways later on in 2021. So there's a couple of things that have occurred. Obviously, Giovanni, the timeline has now been that most leagues that are playing have presented their a preliminary schedule, which I've received. We play a modified 10-game season within our small division only. And then that was presented. It's been final now, to my knowledge. But in between all that, the MIAA sent out its guidelines for playing. And I'm sure you've seen them.
Yes, I have.
They are tough.
Yes, indeed.
They are going to be very difficult, Giovanni, to manage, to maintain. I mean, taking away heading in the high school game is a challenge. I know why they're doing it, or, well, I don't know why. I understand why they think that might help. My concern is we're now going to be asking kids to take balls out of the air because the ball's still going to go in the air. And we're just inviting more contact because now I got to take it down my chest, turn around, take it down my thigh, and I'm just inviting contact. However, I've been argued against that we're not supposed to contact anyways. So it's going to be a challenge, to be honest, from a soccer purist point of view to watch that game initially. But I also think that we count our lucky stars that our kids get to play, because those kids in the spring, baseball players, lacrosse players, track stars, athletes that weren't able to play anything their senior year, at least we're blessed with the opportunity to get out there, build these relationships, and just have fun with the kids and get them some type of soccer season.
You know, when I read through all those modifications, big air quotes there, folks, modifications, you know, the heading one, you know, jumped out at me. And I've come up with the term the battle of the bounce. Because yep. if you can't head the ball, you've got to let it bounce. So once it hits the ground, it becomes live, so to speak. You tie in the quote unquote incidental contact element. I could, and I'm not joking when I say this, I could see situations where the ball's in the air, it bounces, and kids are waiting for it to bounce, you know, to a point where it's not bouncing before they descend upon it. And upon descending the ball, how can you not have incidental contact? I wouldn't want to be a referee. Wouldn't want to be a referee, you know, and I can see, and not to be, you know, Debbie Downer or be a pessimist here, but, you know, one person's interpretation of the battle of the bounce or incidental contact could vary from the other person. You know, if you're doing a, you know, two-man system, which is predominant in high school soccer, you know, their interpretation may be different. And then that just lends to the frustration. Yeah, man, the modifications are indeed significant. I'm being kind here. And I'm real curious to see how the officials, God bless them, are going to be able to sort that out. Again, the battle of the bounce is going to be it's going to be super interesting.
The battle of the bounce is one, right? Because it's going to create an environment where two styles of play will occur. One team, which is interesting because it doesn't really change. So someone was arguing with me that it changes the game. It doesn't. There's a team that play possession, which can still play possession. And then the teams that smash the ball forward and run onto the ball. So I just think you can have more of the same. Some teams will smash the ball forward and try to get that bounce. Other teams will try to move the ball around, knock it around. So it won't change completely the total styles of play. I think that there's going to be moments of the game that will define an entire game simply because of that battle of the bounce.
Indeed.
Like that battle of the bounce, a team could be – but I guess as I look at it, there's those moments of the game in the real game as well. Like one simple bounce goes the other way and, you know, a team that was dominating loses 1-0. So I think that that's something that we'll have to navigate. My big concern is just the how the referees are going to interpret the touch rule. Because in one aspect, it says any hands on a back or any hands on a player is an indirect. As you know, there's no wall. So we're going to have a game full of indirects with no walls.
Right.
So that's what's intriguing to me. And then I have a question for the referees. Cause I don't know if you can help me understand it. There's no wall, but if I get fouled, I can't do a quick restart. But the first person that goes in front of the ball, right, to set up the wall, they're there first. I can't put anyone near him 6 feet, right? Or they can't put anyone near me 6 feet. So it's going to be a race to see who can get in front of the wall first.
Sure.
So it's going to be one of these gamesmanship rules. So hopefully, you know, everyone takes it in stride. But the modifications, I think, are going to be a challenge. Hopefully they lift some of them prior to the season starting.
Yeah, I mean, again, we don't have a crystal ball, but you've got to think if something egregious happened, and I say we use the word egregious, I don't mean it in a negative or a dirty sense, but something really egregious happens, like, oh my God, that's just wacko. You'd like to think that they would say, okay, let's do away with that modification, or let's really kind of scale that one down and move forward, because it's all one big unknown. It's all one big unknown. Yeah, it's going to be terribly, terribly interesting. So Are there protocols in place for testing high school athletes? I mean, is any of that taking place? Is it from school district to school district? What are the protocols, if any, for testing athletes?
So I'll be honest, right now, some of this stuff has been deferred to the Board of Health within every community. I do not believe, I mean, I have my league meeting next Monday to find out if there's anything new. However, I have not heard of any protocols that athletes need to be tested. I think it's simply a honor system and a kind of a self-evaluation of, are you sick? Very similar to the youth sports, right? Are you sick? Do you have a fever? If you've been out of state, like, those are things you should not come to practice, right? I have not heard of everyone having to take a COVID test prior to the season or prior to playing. So the one thing that I know our league has done to try and help mitigate, you know, and work with contact tracing is we will play the same opponent both home and away the same week, which from a competitive point of view really stinks personally. Like, we'll end up going to play North Attleboro Monday, and then they come to us on Wednesday.
Yeah.
So that we don't, you know, so we have limited contact tracing. But I mean, as you know, from a competitive point of view, if I just got smashed by North Attleboro, right, and then I got to go play them again, that lands for a tough week.
It does indeed. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it gets in the how you prepare your team, you know, emotionally, psychologically.
Correct.
Certainly if it's, you know, there's been a lopsided score line in the first game, and yeah, the mental preparation, it's, yeah, the ripple effect of all this is rather significant. You know, along the same lines of testing, and it sounds like there's no real consistency. It goes from a district to district. And I'm not asking you for an answer for this, but this kind of goes through my head. You know, what if Team A plays Team B, and then someone on Team A gets COVID? What happens then? And I'll take it a step further. What happens if Team B plays Team C before Team A player is reported? You know what I'm saying? I mean, is there, does what happens then? Oh my God, you know, Oliver Ames kid got COVID and, you know, they've already played North Attleboro. North Attleboro has already played Foxborough.
Correct.
What happens? So, again, I'm not asking you for an answer, but what happens then?
Listen, this is a challenge. No one really knows, right, Giovanni? At this point now, we're learning, right, as we go, because as I said, there's no real roadmap here for how to deal with it. The understanding I have is that if a player from, like, for example, of our club, if someone's diagnosed from one team, we need to notify that entire team. But of course, we had to keep it anonymous, right? And it'll get something that's a lot along the lines of, please be advised that we have learned that one of your participants has been diagnosed with COVID-19. Your child within the club or team activity was with the individual that was present within the last 14 days prior to the individual's diagnosis. Families of all involved participants are notified in accordance with state and local privacy and confidentiality laws. So at the end of the day, what's going to happen is we are going to probably have to limit or not limit. Well, we'll have to limit your team's involvement if they were exposed to the player. So now the definition of what does exposure actually mean, right, Giovanni? So if you look at CDC, it's 15 minutes
right
of close contact within 6 feet, right? So that's the definition that I've been most recently told by my Board of Health. I don't know many soccer players that are within 6 feet of someone for a total of 15 minutes in a game.
Yep.
To be completely transparent, I just don't. You know, and you've coached at the highest level, even when you man mark a guy or try to mark someone out of a game, very few times are you literally 6 feet on him for a total exposure of 15 minutes. So it's a really tricky question. I've asked my AD, what is our protocol? And to be honest, we're just waiting for Board of Health recommendations, but it's going to be anyone that has contact with them must quarantine for 14 days or get a COVID test. But your question is incredibly important, which is why we need to remember that this disease is very dangerous, because once it gets exposure into one section or one group of people, one cohort, it can rapidly spread through a whole other cohort and community. So I don't have a great answer, but we have definitely talked about this, and I'm on the same page with you. What happens next?
Right. John, which begs the question, it's my final conversation point here for you. And again, I'm not looking for an answer, but maybe I am. Begs the question, everything we've spoken about, in particular this last bit of conversation here, is the risk really worth it? I mean, is this really all worth it? This is my own opinion, and I'm on the record for saying this. Sports are non-essential. We don't need sports. Do we want sports? Sure, for all the obvious reasons. We don't need them. Do particularly at the youth and the high school level, do we really need to be putting lives at risk just to play a game? So I circle back to the initial question there, John. Is the risk really worth it?
So Giovanni, I'll tell you this, right? And is it worth it in terms of a competitive point of view? No, I don't think there's any risk that is worth the competition value. However, if everyone does their part and follows guidelines and rules, I actually think our kids do need this. So I'll have to just maybe not disagree, but just
come. No, that's fine. No, that's fine.
My kids need socialization. My kids need to be out with people. My kids need to be outside getting physical training. They need to take care of their physical health. My personal kids need the mental health of some type of normal. They're going to be in a classroom for 2 days a week, some people, right? With separated cohorts of 10 kids only for the entire year, right? So that's how my kids are going to be dealing with it. 10 kids, same kids for 2 days a week for the entire year. Then they're going to be on Zoom or Google Meet for the next 3 days for the rest of this year. So although it's not essential by definition, I think it's essential for our kids' lives to get back to normal, back to some type of reality that they can enjoy. And I believe everyone does their part to be safe. We're really minimizing the risk, all right, of these kids getting exposed and then passing it on to their loved ones that are the ones that are really at risk, the older folks in our lives, or those like me that have other immunodeficient, issues. So I would say that I believe it is essential for a number of reasons, but not for the soccer competition portion is my point. I don't think I have to play one game this fall. If I could train and just stay in my cohort, we'd be happy. The challenge is, I don't know if parents would be happy with that decision. But I'd be content if I train my kids 3-4 days a week instead of playing games, keeping them in their cohorts, playing within themselves. I think it's a great thing. So if games were canceled, I'm okay with that. It's the training and getting the kids out there that really make a difference to me, because I think we are going to have a lot of kids in the near future that are just going to have challenges with socialization, challenges with friendships, relationships, trust, just because we're not out there. So for me, I think it's worth it, which is why we're putting the time and effort to make it as a safe environment as possible, because I absolutely think that these kids need to be out there, right? And then from my league perspective, because I also work with the CCL, the Club Champions League here, managing a league, there's a lot of other question marks we have. For example, traveling into different states. There's the red zones. There's yellow zones. So there's so many of these conflicts of, like, is the game as important as the playing and getting together? I don't think so. However, I do think that sports and getting our kids out there is essential.
You know, I think, and I think you and I would agree on this, and I think everyone hearing this would agree on this. We just look forward to the day when this is very much in the rear view mirror, where we can return to some sense of normalcy. My ultimate goal, and I try to be, I'm a realist by my own definition, but and I sprinkle optimism as much as I can. For me, the glass is always half full. I would like to think, John, that when this is all said and done, that we as a soccer community, we as soccer coaches, we as people who teach the game and are influential in the game, we are all the better for it, that we have grown, we have evolved, we've become more appreciative of the game, our friends, our colleagues, the players, the parents. And then, you know, the penultimate hope is that we, and I don't mean to pontificate here, we as a society, we as a culture, we as a global community become the better for it. Because as we talked about, and we all know, we've all heard it, this is historic. This is something that obviously never happened before. So my hope, John, is that we're all better for it. We're just all better for it, which means, I guess maybe in a twisted sort of way, might have been a little bit worth. I mean, God, I hope it, I wish it never happened, but it has. But maybe the silver lining behind all of this is that we're all the better for it. We're all the better for it. So
I would agree with that.
Yeah, man. So, John, let's end on a little lighter, brighter note. If somebody wanted to contact John Barata, wanted to learn more about Eastern U Soccer or Legacy or about your program at Oliver Rame, what's the best way to get a hold of John Barata?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm open to chat to anyone about anything. As you know, doing coach education, it's always great to meet new friends and colleagues. And sometimes acquaintances become best friends, and former, you don't have to say enemies, become friends as well, just through working together, right? So anyone that wants to get in touch with me can just use the John, JohnBarata at NELegacySoccer.com. So it's NE for New England, LegacySoccer.com. And I'm happy to chat about anything soccer related and just really always learning about the game. So that'd be great for me, Giovanni, if anyone was interested in catching up or connecting. And one thing I want to mention to you is thank you again for having me on today. It's always great to talk soccer, and it's also a wonderful time to talk about things that have a lot of meaning. And again, a lot of this is my personal opinion in regards to what occurs and how I see things in the game. So I do hope that if anyone has questions about it, they can contact me directly, and I'm happy to clarify or build upon any of my thoughts and my points of view here. But thank you for what you're doing with the GP Soccer podcast. I mean, it is a fantastic resource. I've had a chance to listen to some of your guests, and very, very good content. And hopefully this will just be one of those good shows that people like, or it'll just skip over and go to a better one. So either way, thanks for all you do with the podcast.
Oh, no, John, they're not going to skip over this one. They're not going to skip over this one. So I appreciate the kind words. Yeah, this little podcast is not little anymore. It's kind of taken off, which is a good thing, which is why I do it. You know, it's that the audience has expanded exponentially, and it's listened to in different countries, which is pretty cool. And it's, you know, I do market it. I do push it. I do promote it. And as I always say, if you like what you hear, tell everyone, that type of thing. So I do appreciate the kind words. And to the audience, to John's point about connecting with him, again, I don't say this because he's a friend of mine. And again, if I didn't believe it, I wouldn't say it. If you're involved in a youth soccer organization or a club, and you know, you still want to learn, you need some guidance, you need a reference, you need a model, you need a mentor to help you navigate your way through this COVID-19 issue relative to what you're doing with your organization, certainly contact John. As you have now learned throughout the course of this conversation, they've got it down. Youth soccer with Legacy and over at Oliver Ames and in that community, they've gone through great pains, appropriate pains, to ensure that they do it the right way. So if you need to learn, you know, John's a good resource. John is definitely a good resource. So our guest today was indeed John Barata. We're going to break for a commercial message, a very short one. And then on the other side, we will reconnect with more of the GP Soccer Podcast. I'm Giovanni Pacini, the GP Soccer Podcast. We'll see you on the other side. Don't you dare go anywhere. Hey there, this is Giovanni Pacini, host of the GP Soccer Podcast. You all know me as a soccer coach and a clinician, but did you know that I'm a professional voiceover artist as well? My voice has been heard on radio, television, as well as other media platforms. If you'd like to learn more about my services as a voiceover artist, contact me at gp4voiceover@gmail.com. That's GP, the number 4, voiceover@gmail.com, or at 617-968-1800.
Hi, this is Renato Capobianco, the men's soccer coach at Regis College, and you're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast, hosted by Giovanni Pacini.
Welcome back to the GP Soccer Podcast. Thanks once again to our guest, my friend, John Barata. Really enjoyed that conversation. I'm sure you did too. So, some local news slash international news, some big news. World Cups are a big deal, obviously, arguably. The biggest deal, the biggest event in the world of soccer and arguably in the world of sports. And here in the Boston area, it's very exciting. The local officials, numerous entities representing the Boston area and certainly New England are making a pitch for the 2026 World Cup, which will be hosted at Gillette Stadium. So they do this in this day and age, nothing is live. So they do a Zoom meeting with FIFA representatives who are situated in Zurich. And you had entities such as the Revs, obviously, the New England Revolution, the Kraft Sports and Entertainment, and obviously several local groups that this would impact from the Boston area, all making their pitch to have Boston be designated as one of the World Cup sites for 2026. Greater Boston Convention and Visitors Bureau, Greater Boston Sports Partnership, and the City of Boston. You know, everybody wants a piece of the action, and can't say as I blame them. The decision on all of this won't be made to the middle of next year, so we get a little ways to wait. The good news is Boston's already kind of made the first cut, if you will, of cities, and I think there are 17 cities that remain for the final 10 slots. And you got to think that Gillette, Boston, New England has to be a favorite. I mean, we've done this before. We hosted games during the 1994 World Cup, at Foxborough Stadium, and, the Crafts obviously own the Revolution, the Patriots, and have a wonderful facility down there in Foxborough. The competition, if you will, we've got Atlanta, Baltimore, Cincinnati, Dallas, Denver, Houston, Kansas City, Los Angeles, Miami, Nashville, New York / New Jersey, Orlando, Philly, San Francisco, Bay Area, Seattle, and Washington. So those are our competitors, folks. That's who we're competing against. And I guess the next step in this process will be an actual site visit. I don't think that's been scheduled yet. I dare say that's a pretty safe thing to say because of the COVID-19 pandemic, but that will be scheduled at some point when it is safe to do so. And the other thing about, as a side note, with 2026, it'll be the largest World Cup to date with 80 games, 60 of which will be in the United States, 10 will be in Canada, and 10 will be in Mexico, featuring 48 national teams. This is a large event, as you very well, if you follow the game with any regularity, any seriousness, that FIFA has decided to expand the field of participants for the Men's World Cup. I noted a little bit earlier there, but, it has a significant economic impact. The Boston Consulting Group had estimated that any host city, not just Boston, could see as many as 450,000 visitors and a potential net economic impact upwards to, drum roll please, $480 million. Big deal, folks. That's a big deal. So, I'm going to predict. I'm going to be very bold now. Here's a gutsy move, right? I'm going to predict that Boston / Gillette Stadium will be one of the venues that will indeed host games for the 2026 World Cup. You heard it here, folks, from Giovanni Pacini. I think that's a pretty safe bet. I think you should make the safe bet as well. So big news there. We can only hope that indeed comes to fruition. That's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. Again, I will continue to thank all of you for allowing me into your ears. Through your headsets or your speakers with the GP Soccer Podcast. Again, this little show is not so little anymore. If there's any indication of its popularity, and it's the quality of folks that are very quick to say, yes, I'd love to be on your show. And today was no exception with John Barata. But, if you go back to season one and season two, the list of guests I have had on the GP Soccer Podcast is they're wonderful, wonderful, world-class people from all different areas of the game, from here locally, regionally, nationally, and even internationally. So I encourage all of you to go back to season one and season two, and listen to some of those shows. Heck, binge watch. Start at season one, episode one, and just take it all the way up to where we're at today. If you really want to be a junkie. In any event, thanks again for listening. I really appreciate that. And you know. If you like what you heard today, tell everyone. If you didn't, tell everyone anyway. If you'd like to advertise on the GP Soccer Podcast, yes, indeed, you can contact me, Giovanni Pacini, at GP4Soccer. That's the number 4 at yahoo.com or at 617-968-1800. This is Giovanni Pacini, the GP Soccer Podcast, and I'll catch you later.